It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some governors eliminate degree requirements for hard-to-fill government jobs. Brookings says Virginia, the 13th one. We discuss hiring in Wisconsin and the paper ceiling effect and the public sector workforce. The metaphor for the paper ceiling effect being preventing skilled workers from progressing in their career because they don't hold a certain academic degree. Call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Yockey is director of the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, a professor of public affairs and political science. Susan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. I'm so delighted to be here.
So you're worried about the future of workforce recruitment for government jobs and the public sector, that jobs describing public service at a crossroads. What do you see?
The real worry with the public sector workforce is the graying of government. So it turns out that a huge portion of our federal government workforce, as well as our workforce here in Wisconsin, is getting older. Some people call it the silver tsunami. And those numbers are pretty scary when you think about how much of our lives are touched by the implementation of government policy by our state and federal workforce.
And so you see this huge wave of retirements. And with that, you also see opportunity, but you're losing that institutional knowledge with these retirements as well. So what are the opportunities, but also the concerns there of this aging workforce?
Now, let me give you just a little bit of a statistical picture of that aging workforce, right? So according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, about a quarter of our public sector employees are over 55. And that number approaches about 30% if you look just at the federal government. You know, on the flip side of that, in the federal government, only about 7% of our federal workforce is 30 or younger, right? So you can see here that these numbers don't quite add up. And we want to think hard about what kind of implications that might have. So there is, I mean, this is a problem. It's a problem we got to identify. And if we really want to meet are the challenges that are going to be facing government going forward, and they're going to be intense and important to all of us, we do need a very strongly trained workforce in the public sector.
You've talked about a bipartisan push to remove some degree requirements from government jobs, creating a larger pool of candidates. And Wisconsin has yet to take these steps, in the public sector. What do you worry Wisconsin is losing out on?
Well, I think actually I'm going to change it from a worry to an opportunity. I think there's really two big paths that we can pursue that are both sort of exciting and also provide a broader swath of folks' opportunities into the public sector workforce. So you already mentioned one, and that is that a number of other states are, according to the National Governors Association, in their states, looking at states like Colorado, Maryland, Utah, Pennsylvania, Alaska, so states with both Republican leadership and Democratic leadership, there's a push toward removing college degree requirements for the vast majority of the state workforce hiring. And I actually think that is fabulous. You know, here I am, a college professor saying that's fabulous. That's fabulous because the focus of that, of all hiring, ought to be in kind of preparation and competencies and skills. And, you know, that's what college does. You know, college provides preparation, competencies, and skills. But you can get those in other ways as well, through workforce training programs, through technical colleges, through on-the-job training. And so the idea of growing the number and type of people that can come into the public sector, I think, is just absolutely terrific. And in my mind, you know, why would a college degree, and at least the paper of a college degree, be so meaningful in having those opportunities? So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we have to acknowledge that the type of work in government, at least for some portion of government work, is getting more and more complicated. And we need to have people who are better trained on average, than less trained, right? So we need people that can understand the implications of AI for our changing delivery of services. We need to have people that can understand and interpret high-level statistics and data analytics. We can't have our government workforce be less prepared and less trained than our nonprofit and our private sector workforces. They need to be on par so they can have robust and important communications about the implementation of public policy. And so if on the one hand we're democratizing who can apply for public sector work, and we should, on the other hand, the kind of training that at least some section of our public sector workforce will need to be successful is actually becoming more complicated, more analytic, more driven by the kind of changes that are occurring in our society.
Oh, thank you for giving us more clarity on both of those two avenues going forward as we talk about the changing public service workforce in Wisconsin. Susan Yockey here, director of the Follett School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. You can join in the conversation about skill-based jobs, about hiring, about the workforce you see in the public sector, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Susan, in that one path of not necessarily needing a college degree, a four-year degree, what public service jobs could be done without the four-year degree?
So I think there's a fair amount of jobs that could have on-the-job experience that would be gathered, right? So if you think about work within our DNR, for instance, collecting data, working with constituents, leading public meetings, gathering and talking with constituents to understand the implications of different government policies on their daily lives. Those could be some examples of work that could be done without a college degree, for instance. I should say that, those kind of jobs can be very competitive as well. And so thinking about, technical college training and other kind of training mechanisms, including, college degrees, that could serve as ways to develop skills and competencies will be important, even if the actual requirement to have a college degree is removed.
I wonder, as you watch what government is doing across the nation, are they moving toward these, no four-year degree required because of the pressures with staffing and workforce and turnover and retirement? Or is there a sincere movement to broaden your pool and remove barriers, in government jobs? What are the thoughts behind these changes?
Well, you've actually nailed the two big ones, and I think that they are both working in tandem. This idea of, being more open, being more equitable, not, having a broader swath of folks that can apply for government jobs and public sector jobs. But it's also the case that we do have this graying of government, and we do need more public sector employees going forward. It turns out that right now, about one in five young adults actually want to work in government. So there's actually a strong feeling that it can be an important sector to provide value. And so the trick is converting those folks and connecting those folks with jobs that they are trained and able to do.
Susan Yockey leads the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison as we discuss skills-based hiring in government jobs and the new skill sets for a new generation of government workers. And share what you think. Call in with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss how to remove barriers for workers who lack a college degree and how state governments may view their job vacancies in the future as some states drop degree requirements for harder-to-fill positions. You can join the conversation at any point about careers and hiring. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Yockey is director of the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. Susan, how is public policy education changing to reflect the new demands of the government workforce?
We already mentioned one way, and that's to really focus on kind of competencies and skill development. And that's what we're doing at La Follette, the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. One of the things we're seeing is this overwhelming interest amongst our undergraduates at UW-Madison in public policy generally. A lot of those folks want to work with government. So we have been developing new programs to respond and really focusing those programs on, guess what, competencies and skill development. So allowing students to learn about public policy, learn about analyzing public policy, really digging in to figure out what policies work, what policies don't work, and why. So really thinking about evaluating the effectiveness and efficiency of public policies. You know, those are the kind of, you know, pretty high level analytic skills, often using, you know, big data sets, using advanced statistical techniques that we ought to be teaching our public sector workforce at UW-Madison. And we didn't have programs in the past that addressed those issues. But La Follette has developed some new certificate programs in public policy and health policy, and they're growing like wildfire. They have increased sixfold, actually, in the last couple years. And they're starting to match what we're seeing on other college campuses across the country, which is a huge interest in undergraduates in public policy education.
I wonder why you think there is such a surge in interest in public policy programs, because when we look at some polling, you know, data, they might give conflicting views of how we feel about government and how it works.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And when you try to distinctly look at public policy versus politics, and I think for a lot of people that distinction probably is meaningless, right? But if you really think about the rancor that's happening in politics, you know, some people, and including some of our young people on campus, see public policy as the solution to that rancor. It's a space where people can actually try to identify what are some common areas of interest, what are some topics that we could try to compromise and negotiate a solution. And I think a lot of young people want to see government do good, at least want to see government not mess anything up, and public policy is a way in which for that to happen and for it to actually be a benefit for society as opposed to kind of the rancor that we are so accustomed to right now.
But it can be very polarizing, and it can be kind of risky. Election clerks receiving death threats, government workers, you know, receive scrutiny from elected officials and others. How might this environment and the scrutiny affect willingness to go into the public sector?
Well, it might, absolutely, right? So as those, you know, you mentioned some really very controversial areas of government service. But it is also the case that polling suggests that about 20% of our young adults want to go into government service. I mean, one of the things I'm sort of surprised at is that you could see young people really trying to run away from government service and public service, and you don't. We just don't see that. We see young people across the country in schools of public policy, and in particular here at UW-Madison, running toward government service and running toward wanting to make change in society, to make the world a better place. And in particular, the La Follette School has been thinking about developing a major in public policy. There's a huge demand on campus for a major in the space.
An undergraduate major, because you have the master's.
Exactly. We have, for 40 years, trained master's students here in Wisconsin, and at really high level analytic skills, and a lot of those folks stay here in Wisconsin and work in local and state government, and we're really proud of that. But recently, this surge in undergraduate interest has caused our faculty to consider creating a major in public policy. And one of the things that, if we do that, one of the things we want to center is our ideas of civility, political negotiation, political compromise, working with people that are different than you to come to solutions for society. And those are skills that we can practice just like any other skills. And they are skills that are sorely needed if we're going to have a functioning public sector moving forward.
I think you mentioned a nonpartisan workforce being so essential in the piece you wrote.
I did. Yeah. I mean, it really is, terrifically important that our public sector workers represent all of us, and that they do so with bearing their expertise, right? So, and that might be expertise that they've learned on the job and learned in technical schools, that might be expertise that they've learned at the LaFalle School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. But that's really why they're hi typically hired. And that's really what they need to do in order to turn, public policy that's been passed by our elected branches of government into the implementable details that affect our daily lives. And that's really what, the bureaucracy, what the public sector agencies do on a day in basis.
Talking about public service workforce in Wisconsin with Susan Yockey. You can join in 800-642-1234. Mike in Franklin has a comment. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm a high school teacher, and one of the things that I see with AP classes and other types of things that we have where they can get both high school credit and college credit for things in the future, I'm not seeing very much attention being paid towards having a job and doing some type of government work. And so I'm wondering how we can integrate things at the from the secondary level up to higher education so that there's a little bit more connective tissue in getting individuals who may be able to get a job right out of high school or with some additional training that to generate the interest at the high school level.
Mike, thank you for that. Susan, what do you have to offer there that could be that connective tissue, as Mike says?
Yeah, well, first of all, Mike, thanks for your service. And this is a great question. Let me describe super quickly a class that I teach for our undergraduates at UW-Madison, because I think Mike, in your AP courses, you could do something analogous to it. And that is, this last semester, some of our undergraduate students at the LaFalle School worked directly with three different state legislators, so three sitting state legislators here in Wisconsin, two Republicans and one Dem, a couple from the Assembly and one Senate member. And what we did was we asked the Wisconsin state legislators, what are some public policy questions that you want answered that you don't have, the staff or the resources to research yourself, that our students can research for you? So our students spent the whole semester, our LaFalle students spent the whole semester researching and preparing big reports for these legislators, comparing the public policy questions that the legislators had against their questions, right? Answering their questions by comparing what other states are doing on these policy topics, and then returned a report, on best practices, essentially a policy analysis of the topic to these legislators, and then also did a oral presentation of their findings in the state capitol, which was really, really neat for the students. So that was a great example of kind of an apprentice-like course that we teach in college. Skills-based competencies provides that connective tissue between what students are learning and what they would be doing in the public sector. And Mike, I think you could do something similar in your class. I mean, maybe not working with legislators, but maybe working
City
with your
Council.
county commissioners or your city officials. And that's a way to bring government work alive.
Oh, that's really interesting. Susan, we only have a few moments left. You thanked Mike for their public service. What would you tell government workers out there who feel burned out?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really important work is what I would say. And, you know, as we move forward, as we move into a generation where analytics, data, AI, you know, we are going to be challenged with a really fast moving private sector. And we just need our public sector employees to be valued, but also to understand that even if, you know, even if you're a Republican out there listening to this, this audio, and you're wondering, like, why do we need such a big public sector workforce? We do. We do in the sense that we need to have efficient and effective policies being implemented. And everybody ought to be able to agree on that.
Susan, thank you for joining us. Susan Yockey, Director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some state governments join a number of companies dropping the degree requirements for certain jobs and widening their pool of candidates. We examine the implications for Wisconsin's workforce and career advancement. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Papia DeBroy is Senior Vice President of Insights at Opportunity at Work. That's a nonprofit urging that skills rather than degrees should be the basis for hiring. Papia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for the invitation to be with you today. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Let's turn our attention first to Virginia becoming the 13th state to remove college degree requirements for jobs within state government. Why is the change happening now?
Oh, it's such a good question. You're absolutely right. There is a trend to what we're calling tear the paper ceiling. And it's exciting because it's being implemented by both Democratic leaders and Republican leaders across the country. And that the action that's happening actually speaks to a lot of what Susan was speaking to earlier today, the critical need to actually rethink standard hiring practices in our labor market that are not really allowing all of our workers to reach their full potential. What we see is that when employers make a decision to shift to skills-based hiring instead of degree-based hiring, we actually surface a vast, overlooked, skilled, and very diverse population of workers who are qualified to do a lot of the work employers are seeking to fill today.
Can you give us some historical context? What has driven a majority of jobs to require a four-year degree in recent years? How did we get here?
Yeah, it's a good question. If you look at historically our workforce population, the majority of our workforce actually does not have a bachelor's degree. In fact, if you look at Wisconsin's workforce, 2.5 million workers are active in the labor force today, and more than 1.5 million of them do not have a bachelor's degree. This population of workers has gained skills in many ways that historically the American workforce has gained skills. They've gained skills through military service, through community college programs. Most commonly, they've actually gained skills by showing up to work every day and getting better at the skills actually required for their role. We call these workers skilled through alternative routes or STARs. Today, they face a newer barrier to upward mobility in the United States. The paper ceiling they face represents degree screens, biased algorithms, stereotypes, exclusive professional networking, opportunities that block their ability to actually demonstrate these skills in higher wage opportunities. If you look at the American workforce, there are more than 30 million workers today who are positioned for significantly higher wage work than they're currently being given access to.
And so when these workers without a bachelor's degree go to seek a new position or perhaps want to be considered for a new position, that is where there can be the barriers to doing that because they just don't have that four-year degree?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, a lot of workers are being screened out of a lot of roles that have historically been open to them. So if you study jobs across the last generation, what you actually see is that many roles that have historically been available to stars are currently being blocked to them. These are occupations ranging from, you know, computer support specialist to HR assistant to registered nurse. These are opportunities where workers are frequently building skills in lower wage occupations that are skills that are transferable to these higher wage jobs. I think a lot of what this movement is about is rethinking how might we think about the skills that workers are gaining through all kinds of pathways and allow any worker who has done the learning to translate that learning to earning in these jobs.
But isn't the degree the evidence? I mean, isn't it the way to determine who can and who can't do certain kinds of work?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I think higher education is a really critical pathway in the United States. It historically has been, and it will absolutely continue to be a really critical pathway. I think one of the things to note in the data is that the inequality between workers with a bachelor's degree and stars has grown really significantly in the past generation. When a star entered the workforce in 1989 at the age of 25, you know, they were earning less than the bachelor's degree worker, and that has historically been the case. But if you track the star for the next 30 years, what you see in this generation is stars never catch up to where the bachelor's degree worker was at the beginning of their career. 30 years into their career, the star is just starting to earn what the bachelor's degree worker was earning at the beginning of their career. That gap is new to this generation, and it's stunning. It's a stunning inequality. And when you look at the skills of the star, what you see is that they are also gaining very valuable skills through pathways that are outside of the bachelor's degree institutions. And so part of what will allow our economy to grow and continue to prosper is that we're tapping into the potential of learning wherever it's happening in the labor market. And a critical part of that is actually allowing stars to gain these skills through whatever pathways they're gaining them through and actually translate them into earnings in higher wage work in the United States.
Papia DeBroy referring to stars as skilled through alternative routes as we talk about the debate surrounding skills-based hiring and degrees. And Papia is the Senior Vice President of Insights at Opportunity at Work. That's a nonprofit studying workers without bachelor's degrees. You can join in the conversation at any point. Questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Papia, what effects are you seeing from the 13 states opting to hire on skills rather than degrees?
We're seeing a lot of excitement, I think. What we see in the data is that good government jobs are frequently out of reach for a lot of workers in the U.S. labor market. In fact, if you look at state and local government employees, they hold bachelor's degrees at higher rates than even federal or private sector employees. And when that's the trend, what we actually are overlooking are an incredibly diverse pool of applicants in the United States. In fact, if you look at the data, when a job requires a degree, employers are automatically screening out almost 80% of Hispanic workers, more than 70% of Black workers, 75% of our rural workforce, and nearly 70% of veterans.
And so this is really having effects on diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging when states are not lifting these required four-year degrees.
That's right. That's certainly one of the impacts.
And so, you know, you want to change the way people talk about workers without a four-year college degree. What does the use of language about low-skilled workers get wrong about this section of the workforce?
One of the things that's actually really critical to understand is that we actually use a lot of deficit-based language to talk about our workforce in the United States. In fact, if you look at a lot of skills that are required for many low-wage jobs, you see that there's very valuable skills that many workers gain in those occupations that are valuable for many more higher-wage occupations in our labor market. And so it does a disservice to the worker to call them low skill when in fact they're gaining quite valuable skills for many parts of our economy. I think one of the attempts we're trying to push forward with the public service campaign to tear the paper ceiling is to bring an asset-based set of terms to how we speak about the workforce. Workers who are skilled through alternative routes, or the acronym STARS, it moves us away from calling workers low skill, sub-baccalaureate, non-BA, a lot of terms that many of us have, you know, just been using in our public discourse in ways that are not actually giving credit to workers for gaining really valuable skills through many different pathways.
Let's take a call now. Nancy joining us from Grafton. Nancy, hi, go ahead.
Well, my husband was a construction worker, a union construction worker. My son's union construction workers. Now my grandsons are now union construction workers. These people did not have any kind of big bills to pay for college, but boy, they sure as heck knew how to work. And you know what? You have insurance, you have good wages. When you retire, you have benefits, you get retirement checks paid. And anyway, so I think there's nothing wrong with going and being with the trades. I don't care if it's a mechanic or electrician or plumber or construction workers. We have a need for people who know how to work. And that, to me, I think you're not left with a big debt that you have to pay back to college or something. But boy, if you can work with your hands and use your head and do the work that we need to have done, that's the way to go.
Nancy, thank you. A resounding yes there for trade schools and people in the trades, Papia.
Absolutely. Nancy, thank you so much for your comment. I 100% agree. There are hundreds of jobs in our labor market. And if you actually study the workers in these jobs, what you see is that STARS occupy almost every occupation, which means that our American workforce has found pathways into all kinds of jobs in the U.S. labor market, both through college and in pathways that don't include college. And I think one of the things that's really important to recognize and understand is how people are learning is also diversifying. And so it's so important that we build a labor market that allows people to translate those learnings into earnings.
Papia DeBroy with us from Opportunity at Work, aiming to help millions of Americans without four-year degrees advance in the career ladder. Join this workforce conversation, call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The group called Opportunity at Work says there's a vast overlooked talent pool of people who are skilled in their work, but they lack a four-year degree. We discuss academic job requirements and mobility. With your thoughts, call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Papia DeBroy is Senior Vice President of Insights at Opportunity at Work. Papia, research from your organization saying 70 million workers are considered skilled through alternative routes than a four-year degree. How should an employer change from a degree-based to a skill-based hiring approach in terms of, you know, evaluating your job descriptions and your internal processes?
Thanks so much for the question. I think it's such an important one. The truth is, we deploy a lot of methods to evaluate candidates for jobs we have at our companies. And, you know, the way that we do that evaluation varies by type of job. It also varies across levels and across geographies. I think one of the first things to consider is, how do we evaluate and figure out if someone is fit for a role if they do have a bachelor's degree? What you see in many occupations is that sometimes we deploy internships, sometimes we deploy apprenticeships, sometimes we deploy assessments, other times we, you know, we deploy a contract to hire process. The key part of skills-based hiring actually being successful is deploying methods we frequently deploy to bachelor's degree candidates to STARS as well. You know, just to give one example of a practical trend we're starting to see much more frequently deployed is to actually provide a candidate a challenge prompt or a performance task that mimics some of the tasks that the worker would need to perform in the job. And, you know, there's certainly a lot to learn in the stages of the journey, and many different occupations will have to test and learn many different methods. But we do think it's a really important shift to actually drive improvements to de-bias the hiring process overall.
So that would that be considered like a skills-based interviewing process?
That's right. I think that's a really critical part to making that shift.
What about, you know, seeing on a job description 4-year degree preferred and not under required in the job description? Is that still an issue?
I think there's kind of three levels we see within job descriptions. So for, you know, bachelor's degree required, bachelor's degree preferred, mm-hmm. and then there are many, many more job descriptions that are not including that requirement at all anymore. I think one of the critical things to understand is that it's a really important signal that employers send through their job descriptions. And so really evaluating them to make sure that the skills that are required for the role are listed very clearly is sending a message to the potential workers who are applying to the role. We will consider you for this position. And I think when you talk to STARS, many of them reflect on an experience where they have applied to hundreds of positions and never heard back from an employer. And this is such a universal story that we hear from STARS today. For employers, I think it's important to recognize and understand that it's an important signal to an individual. And so how do you help that individual recognize and understand, yes, I will consider you for this position, and these are the specific criteria I have to actually ensure that you will be successful in this role?
How can workers with unconventional education backgrounds, how can they find employers who actively and proactively use skills-based hiring methods?
I love that question because one of the critical parts of what we're starting to see in the both the public sector right now, the public sector is leading the way in many respects, but many in the private sector are making this shift as well, as they're signaling that they're looking for STARS. When the state of Maryland made the decision last summer to remove degree requirements and open up their roles to workers who are skilled through alternative routes, they saw a huge bump in applications for a number of positions that they had been struggling to fill. And I think what was so critical about that is that many workers who didn't think that they would be considered for these positions received the message, oh, okay, this is an employer who's willing to consider me for this position. The Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign has started to bring on employers to actually say, yes, I'm one of the employers who is interested in hiring STARS, and I want to send that signal very publicly.
We're talking with Papia DeBroy from Opportunity at Work, a nonprofit studies workers without bachelor's degrees. And you can join in on the skills-based workforce at any point, 800-642-1234. Papia, what is the role of higher education here in advocating for skills-based hiring practices? Because on one hand, you know, four-year colleges and universities are in the business of attracting students and ensuring they matriculate and finish that four-year degree. They need alumni as part of their ability to be an institution of higher ed. So what do you tell these colleges and universities?
Absolutely. Our higher education institution is such a critical part of the fabric of American life. And I think it has been a critical pathway for American workers historically in the United States, and it will continue to be a critical pathway in the future. I think there's two ways to start to think about the role that higher ed can play. First, many higher ed institutions are large employers in their region. And I think that's a really critical dimension that a lot of colleges and universities overlook. But colleges and universities hire all kinds of workers to actually help them be good employers. This includes HR assistants, computer support specialists, nurses. So I think the first step is actually looking at, are we being an inclusive employer in our region? Are we hiring stars into many of these occupations where we know workers are gaining skills in many different pathways in our region? The second is to start to think about how learning that is happening in all kinds of ways on a university campus can be made accessible to a broader population of people in the region, right? A lot of this effort is about helping any individual who learns a skill be able to translate that skill, right, at work. And I think what we have learned so much in the last few years is that people can learn virtually, people can learn in all kinds of settings that were not as accessible to people in the last generation. How do we take the fact that we're learning so much about how many ways we can learn and provide more opportunity to people to actually have access to so much of how people actually access learning more systematically moving forward?
As you look ahead here, 13 states now lifting these requirements, do you see a trend here? Are more states going in this direction?
Absolutely. We do see this trend. There's been a pretty major uptick in the last few months, and certainly we know many states are thinking about this shift as well across the United States. And we think it's really exciting because many others are following the public sector in this way.
Do you think that the workforce challenges we're seeing is causing states to go this direction, or is it something else?
I think there are multiple reasons that an employer can make this choice. Certainly, it opens up a pool of candidates that is far more vast than what they typically see through more traditional channels. Mm. But in addition to that, I think a lot of employers are starting to recognize just how skilled a lot of workers are who did not go through the bachelor's degree route. Our estimates actually suggest that of the 70 million stars in the U.S. labor force, more than 30 million have skills to make transitions to a job that would pay on average at least 50% more today.
Wow.
Those workers are not gaining access or opportunity to those jobs.
Papia, thank you for joining us. Papia DeBroy, Senior Vice President of Insights at Opportunity at Work. And earlier, we heard from Susan Yockey, Director of the UW-Madison School of Public Affairs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.